Okay, this will work. All right. Over the past 10 years, we've experienced an extraordinary housing price convulsion, which Alicia and Chris have both told us about. According to the Case-Shiller 20-city price index, real prices in this country rose by 74% in those 20 cities between 2000 and 2006. We then gave back more than 75% of that gain, both at the national level and city by city, which is what you're seeing in front of you, is the enormous variation in cities, in the experience that different metropolitan areas had, and the fact that those cities that experienced more boom experienced more bust. And again, it's about 75 cents on the dollar, that cities gave back. There are two great questions, I think, that I at least have going forward on this. The first of which is, what caused this boom? How in the world can we understand it? And unfortunately, what I'm going to say here today is not to give you a neat, tied-up explanation that's going to make sense of it, but rather to say that the prevailing wisdom, the common wisdom for understanding, is just doesn't have that much behind it. And that, in fact, we're going to have to dig a lot deeper and make sense of a lot more do a lot more work to actually try and make sense of it, if indeed we are ever able to do so. On the other hand, I do agree with Chris that, in fact, on the second question, which is what in the world are we going to do about this, I think actually there are easy answers. I think they're not that they will prevent a housing bubble next time, but that they will reduce the damage, that they will, in fact, cause less harm to average homeowners. And indeed, that the easiest thing is to stop encouraging homeowners to leverage themselves to the hilt to bet on the vicissitudes of the housing market. While I do not believe that the home mortgage interest reduction or any of the federal policies that encourage lending bear the guilt for creating the crisis, we certainly did bear, as a country, responsibility for encouraging people to borrow as much as possible to bet on that housing, those housing price changes. And I think that just looks spectacularly foolish with the evidence of the past 10 years. So many prominent economists have been associated with the view that low interest rates can explain the bubble. The theory that lies behind this is quite simple. It's that the cost of carrying home is some number, which is the basic interest rate cost, plus some other set of things like local tax rates, times prices, right? That's our cost of carrying a home, and that's of course correct. If the cost of renting and the cost of owning are equal, and if the rental cost stays more or less constant, then this sort of predicts that prices will go up one for one as interest rates drop. This is the logic that led to articles like Bubble Trouble Not Likely, which was published in the Wall Street Journal in 2005, that suggested that due to relatively benign interest rate environments, it was perfectly reasonable for people to pay absolutely extraordinary prices for housing during the boom. There are reasons, however, why this logic from a theoretical point of view is actually not right. Why, in fact, it seems to suggest a much stronger link than even economic theory predicts it should exist. And there are reasons why, in fact, we should expect to see empirically a much weaker link. And indeed, when you look empirically, you actually see the link that economic theory would predict, a more sophisticated economic theory would predict, not this very simple model. Let me just mention four reasons why this simple logic is misleading. The first of which is that housing supply in many areas is elastic. And in fact, builders can keep on building. It doesn't matter what interest rates are in Las Vegas or Phoenix or Houston or Dallas. As long as builders can continue producing housing at $80 a square foot and land is more or less free, housing prices aren't going to get a lot above $80 a square foot. The simple logic of economics and supply and demand is not overruled by an interest rate logic. And just because credit is cheap, prices shouldn't skyrocket. Indeed, in much of what I'll call the elastic part of America, the part where housing prices are set by supply, there wasn't a housing price bubble. There was a big construction boom, but there wasn't, in fact, in places like Dallas or Houston, a huge increase in prices, and there hasn't been a huge decrease since then. The second reason is that in a reasonable economic model, when interest rates are low, people will understand that in the future interest rates will be higher. And if they're not totally short-sighted, they'll take that into account when buying. And they should recognize, and indeed I think there's evidence that people do recognize, the fact that interest rates are volatile. In the same sense that the refinancing option also means that the current interest rate doesn't determine the long-run cost of a mortgage to you. If interest rates are temporarily high, people can refinance. And the fourth reason, which is a little bit technical but important for economists, is one of the things that made people think that bubble trouble was not likely was that in areas where you have housing price appreciation, if you use the current interest rate to assess the future, it means that when interest rates are low, the fact that, you know, housing prices in San Francisco or New York are expected to continue to rise, those low interest rates make that rising enormously valuable. So that sort of suggests that people are perfectly unconstrained, perfectly able to borrow as much as they want at current credit rates, and that also will create a very powerful link between interest rates and prices, if this occurs. Again, there's no reason to think that there's any reality behind that, that in fact many borrowers are in fact credit constrained, and this effect won't work. These effects together can reduce the predicted impact of interest rates by more than 75%. So incorporating a more nuanced, a more sophisticated model knocks down the common logic of the user cost formula by about 75%. Now, what does the data say? Well, the data says that the long-term relationship between prices and real rates is about 6.8%, and that's in the best-case scenario, meaning that 100 basis point swing in the real interest rates, to show you the graph here, is associated with about a 6.8% increase in housing prices. That's actually what the model tells you it should be. You get about 7%. You get about 8% if you focus on areas at the low end of the interest rate spectrum, so the effect gets slightly bigger. But even at 8%, you just multiply that 8% effect, right? Again, 100 basis point swing, a 1 percentage point swing in the interest rates is associated with an 8% increase in prices. Multiply that by the 130 basis point drop in real rates that you experienced between 2000 and 2006. What do you get? You get a 10.4% increase in prices, not a 74% increase in prices. Okay? My job here is not to exculpate Alan Greenspan or the Fed. I am not saying in any sense that the Federal Reserve policy during the early years of this decade was wise. I'm not a monetary economist. I don't have an opinion. But I do know that those who would blame low interest rates or 100 basis point swing in the real rates for one of the most momentous housing market events of all time, that they are, you know, working against both economic theory and what we know about the statistical relationship between interest rates and housing prices. It is also true that in fact the interest rate effect appears to be somewhat stronger in places like New England. And this is actually an important point about the bubble, that in fact the price changes were much stronger in places that where housing supply was relatively inelastic. That again is just what the model would suggest, just what economic theory would suggest. In places like Dallas and Houston, where building is easy, you saw much more of a construction effect and much less of a price effect. That's exactly what we experienced. And it's yet another reason to think about whether or not we actually want building rules to be so restrictive in greater Boston. The typical inelastic area saw real prices grow by 98% from 96 to 06. The median elastic area saw real prices grow by 18.4%. Okay, other credit market effects. So we were able to look at two other credit market institutions. We were able to look at approval rates and loan-to-value rates. Now, some of the punchline on this was already shown by Alicia Sasser's presentation, which is that these variables just didn't change very much over the boom. But we were able to estimate effects on mortgage approval rates using Home Mortgage Disclosure Act data. We were able to look at on a metro area by year basis, and we're able to control for individual characteristics and then estimate just how easy was it to get an approval in these various places in these various years. It is absolutely true, and I'll show you this next, that as the mortgage approval rate goes up, prices went up as well. So we do, in fact, estimate a positive effect, and we can undertake a number of fancy statistical measures to try and deal with a reverse causality issue that rising prices may make it easier to get mortgage approval. So we've addressed this issue as well as possible as well. But when you do this, you find an effect of 0.77 to 2.52, meaning that if it's 2.52, as the approval rate goes up by 5%, you get a 12.5% increase in prices that are associated with it. Again, mortgage approval rates actually fell, as you saw on the graph, between 2000 and 2006, and they only went up by 3.8% between 2000 and 2005, which is the best you know window that we could get for this hypothesis. At best, that again gives you a 10% increase, and I think a more realistic number would be, you know, something less than 5. So again, very little of the housing price increase is explained by mortgage approval rates. We also did this with loan-to-value effects. Again, prices do rise with loan-to-value effects, but they don't rise by enough to explain the bubble. Again, LTV rates, again, taking the biggest change, the median LTV only rises from 84% to 88% from 1998 to 2006. Again, not nearly enough to get you very much of this. At best, the factors together can get you a third of what America experienced. I'm not meaning to say that the credit market policies were good or wise. I'm not meaning to suggest that easy approval was a good policy. But these effects don't explain the bubble. And the problem is, of course, that there is no obvious alternative. Yes, it is certainly true that this great maelstrom that impacted our housing markets was born high on utterly unrealistic expectations, especially in places like Las Vegas and Phoenix. But the fact that those expectations were so high just begs the question of where did they come from? Expectations aren't some innate, exogenous event. What in the world made people so unduly optimistic? And I think that's really what we have to understand going forward. Now is where I pivot to policies going forward. And I think there are two policy takeaways and two reasons to focus on the subsidization of mortgages that come out of what I've just said. One of which is that housing price volatility can be enormous and can be unexplained. And as a result, we need to be very careful about encouraging people to expose themselves to that. The second reason to pivot, the second connection between what I've just said and what I'm about to say, is that if you think the link between credit markets and prices is weaker, then we can be more confident that it's okay even now to consider making mortgages more expensive for some people, for wealthy people, for mortgages at the very high end. So in any point like this, there are two competing contradictory impulses, one of which is to double down and create even more support for buying. And that was the impulse that gave us the home buyer's tax credit that encourages us to try and, push housing prices up to stop the decline. But we've had 6 months of stability, at least in terms of prices, and I think it's time to move to the second impulse that comes out of the decline, which is reform, which is to try and enact policies that will make it less painful next time. And the most natural thing to reform is to rethink those policies that subsidize lending. The federal government did not cause the bubble, but subsidizing borrowing with the home mortgage interest deduction and the GSEs certainly didn't help. Okay, let me give you four quick reasons to be against subsidized borrowing, in particular in the way that we do it right now. Reason number one is that since prices go down as well as up, promoting borrowing can lead to a foreclosure rather than an ownership society. Okay? It's just madness to encourage people to leverage themselves to the hilt to bet on the vicissitudes of housing. It just makes very, very little sense. It's not a recipe towards encouraging asset accumulation. It's a recipe towards encouraging people to take on large amounts of risk. This would be less true if we just encouraged home ownership, but since we do it by encouraging leverage, it's particularly mad. Right? It's particularly insensible. Secondly, promoting home ownership means being against density and being for sprawl. 86% of single family detached houses are owner occupied, while 86% of units in three or more unit structures are rented. When we encourage people to own, we're telling them to leave multi-unit dwellings and we're telling them to leave the cities. Car commuting is 10% higher among homeowners. It makes very little sense to have policies that handicap our cities and to encourage people to live in places where energy use is higher. This is the relationship across cities between the share of the family that's single-family detached and owner-occupied, right? Those two things are one and the same. Encouraging owner-occupied means encouraging people to live in large single-family detached houses. Encouraging people to borrow to bet on housing also leads them to buy bigger homes, and that also makes no sense. Already, the poorest American consumes twice as much living space per capita than the average Englishman or the average French household. That we don't have a problem with people under-consuming. In fact, when people consume more housing, what they're doing is they're consuming significantly more energy, and in a world in which we may be worried about energy use and climate change, how in the world does it make sense to encourage people to buy bigger homes? Homes with between 2,500 and 3,000 square feet of heated living space use 41% more electricity than homes with between 1,500 and 2,000 square feet of living space. Why are we encouraging people to be living in bigger homes? Reason four is homeownership and redistribution. The way that we've stacked the home mortgage interest deduction is, of course, wildly regressive. According to work by NBER President Jim Peterba and Todd Sinai, tax savings are $523 per year in taxes for homeowning families earning between $40,000 and $75,000 a year, but there are $5,459 per year for families earning more than $250,000 a year. The fact that it is so stacked towards wealthier people also means that it is very poorly targeted towards increasing homeownership, because by by and large, these wealthier people would be owning in any case. And the bulk of the benefits do not go to the people who are actually on the margin between owning and not. So if you actually wanted to design a program to encourage homeownership, the home mortgage interest deduction is spectacularly poorly designed for doing just that. I don't think that we need to actually even make a rule against promoting home ownership. There are reasons why home ownership is attractive, but the current strategy is particularly nonsensical. And certainly if you gave me my preferred option, it would be a small annual tax credit to those people who own rather than rent, if indeed we have to have a policy that promotes home ownership at all. But I think a more realistic policy going forward is just to lower the cap on the home mortgage interest deduction, which currently sits at $1 million, just to lower it by $100,000 per year for the next 7 years till it reaches a $300,000 cap, which is exactly where President Bush's tax reform panel suggests that it should lie in 2005. Right, so there's nothing that I'm saying that is radical or anti anything, but just lowering that cap so that we reduce the incentive for people to leverage themselves to the hilt to bet on the vicissitudes of the housing market. These bubbles will continue. We don't understand them. It will take decades before we're actually able to make sense of them and to figure out what policy cocktail will reduce the probability of these bubbles occurring. But as long as they do occur, let's not encourage people to expose themselves as much as possible. Not only should we mandate that there be enough lifeboats on the Titanic, let's not give people subsidized tickets to take trips through the North Sea during iceberg season, which is essentially what we're doing right now. So let me stop there.